This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast where we talk about new books in media and communications. I am your host, Marcy Maserato. With me today is Jonathan Beller, author of the book, The World Computer, Derivative Conditions of Racial Capitalism. Jonathan, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So to start, I would like to hear a little bit more about your background, your professional educational background. What has brought you to this point?
Okay. Starting as a literature PhD student, I was very interested in the relationship between aesthetics and social change. And I got interested in the way in which decolonial literature and Global South or Third World literature at the time was challenging the social conditions as I grew up in them and as I understood them. But my studies made me realize also that some of the revolutionary aspirations of the writers that I was reading were yet unrealized. And the media ecology around me also made me think about cinema and visual culture as becoming more and more powerful in securing the world as it was. So I became very aware that maybe there were limits at the time on the literary endeavor and that visual culture was becoming increasingly important. That realization sort of drove me into looking at a lot of film and thinking about cinema and radical cinema. And so I thought about, I began to see that cinema was also trying to transform the social order in really important ways. And that by disrupting patterns of visualization, you also changed patterns of understanding and created new relationships. So there's a lot there, but that was sort of the fundamental impetus, the recognition that visuality was not something that was just natural or given, but it actually been sculpted through a historical process, and that the way we saw the structuring of our perceptions and our apperceptions had a deep political instantiation. So the technical dimensions of that became very interesting, and I wrote a book on cinema as my dissertation, thinking about the organization of not only the visual and the psychological, but even the cognitive and the social by these cinematic relations. And I called that book The Cinematic Mode of Production. The cinematic mode of production was kind of the precursor to the rest, and it's still an important touchstone for me in the way that I think. I mean, the new book recasts a lot of the arguments on that older text because I understand cameras and optics quite differently than I did at the time. But that intervention in the production and reproduction of social relations by a medium became really central to me as I understood the cyberneticity, I suppose, of sociality.
Okay, so this has really been something that you have been pondering for a long time.
Yeah, like my whole life. Yeah. Well, all that I remember anyway.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, sometimes it's a particular kind of a side project. So this is really something that you have dedicated your life to studying and continue studying. And so that's really fascinating. So when you talk about the world computer, which is, this is really an excellent book that for me as an academic, there's a lot of things that I was like, oh, I gotta, okay, great. It's like, it's inspiring to be like, wow, this is a really, because you really dive into the system, but the way that you do it, the way that you talk about it is a little different than what a lot of the literature that's already out there. So when you talk about the world computer, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was trying to think about the global AI or the global operating system that currently seems to have the world in its grip and is directing us towards a path towards Armageddon. I mean, that's a lot to say, and maybe it sounds a little bit cheesy because, it's very science fiction-y. But what I had in mind really was kind of the virtual machine of racial capitalism. And that as I think about the conditions of possibility for future actions, I see that they're overdetermined and structured by the sedimentation of the logic and practices and meanings and systems of racial capitalism. So, that's saying a lot. I mean, you could also think about the world computer as being in dialogue with world systems theory and the Wallerstein kind of stuff, but also connected to notions of the coloniality of race, like Anibal Quijano talks about, or the coloniality of gender, like Maria Leonis talks about. We have these huge systems of abstraction emerging to effectively encode bodies and create the conditions for various actions, many of them violent, to be taken in relationship to these bodies for the purposes of value extraction. And so the world computer names the virtual machine, which coordinates and ordinates the conditions of production in global racial capitalism.
And what brought you to the idea of specifically of looking at race and racial capitalism?
That's an interesting question because it's become so obvious to me that that is a fundamental consideration when trying to analyze world organization that I hadn't really thought about the origins of that realization for a while. But I mean, it's basically I take these axes of race and gender as axiomatic in the organization of the social, and to me, understanding capitalism is not really possible without also understanding a la Cedric Robinson and Black Marxism, for example, the history of racialization that goes along with it. Because the organization of societies by this emergent category of race became part of the ways in which capital discounted the value and the claims of other people on the social and licensed many forms of violence, which include settler colonialism, what's sometimes called primitive accumulation, all the forms of industrialization and toxic dumping, which take place to this day.
And how do you think... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's a really interesting book that just came out recently by Andreas Malm and the Zetkin Collective called White Skin, Black Fuel, which also demonstrates without any doubt in my mind, if there were any doubts anywhere, that to be someone who denies the reality of climate change and denies the need to change ecological processes and energy processes is also a continuation of a racist logic. And so sometimes we don't know how to see the connections of the operations of race and racism or gender and heteropatriarchy in these systems, which seem so abstract and informatic. And part of my work is really about showing that computation is a racial formation and that computation is a gendering formation. And to bring out the social dimensions of these abstract machines, which seem that they're more mathematical, informational, and asocial.
And so when we look at, the history of the United States, when you look at it from a historical perspective, we can, it's really important to look at the fact that in the US, and it's not exclusive to us, but that we really are a country that was fundamentally built on within a racist structure, right? And so this is, you know, before we have these kind of technological structures in relation to the world computer, as you mentioned. How do you think that these things connect in terms of the history of being built on a very patriarchal, racist ideology and practices?
Yeah, I mean that is sort of the one of the challenges in the writing of the book is to make those connections, or at least surface pathways in which those connections can be made, where you have the encoding through what's someone like Stuart Hall or Simone Brown calls epidermalization of the practices around particular bodies, which are a licensed or executable, right? So who can be sold as a slave? Who can be enslaved? There's a coding process which allows that certain people can and certain people can't, which is actually much more complex than my text can account for. But the history of enslavement is a way of writing various social logics on bodies. And what's important to see is that that affects not only who's written, but who reads. And so the process of the history of slavery in the United States is also a subject making practice for whiteness and white masculinity. And that this violent process, which is, as you say, foundational in the history of the United States and affects probably every place in the world in one way or another, becomes a process of encoding, which then gets built into our other relationships. I mean, it evolves through its percolation through juridical processes, through institutions, through ideology, through psychology, and those normalizations become part of what is encoded as machines begin to emerge and become decisive in the social.
And you're looking this specifically within the context of power, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, to me, the one of the other things that became really important to me in my writing and my teaching is to recognize that these things, which seem to operate in a kind of normative vein and naturalize social relations, are actually institutionalized through violent processes, and in many cases reproduce and even exacerbate those violences. My screen went to sleep. I want to make sure you're still there. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah. So power is absolutely central, and power is operational even in the most seemingly innocent transmissions. The book before this one was called The Message is Murder, because in part I wanted to foreground the fact that everyday communication rests on a sea of blood, and that our computational institutions, our energy production, our other institutions, the military industrial complex, the carceral system, all of these things are today conditions of possibility for the operation of our machines. And the operation of those machines in producing the billionaires that they do and many of the other social relations which allow those billionaires to continue to stand are part of the way in which violence is normalized planet-wide.
And you start your argument in the book by talking about the social difference engine and the world computer. And then you move on to really talking about what you title the computational unconscious, technology as a racial formation. Can you talk about more about how that racial formation, I mean, you've touched on it a little bit. Can you talk more about how the unconscious really fits in with your argument there? And how you introduce this topic?
Yeah, there are a lot of different strands that I could try to pick up, but I mean, among them is this notion, as I was talking about earlier, that visual culture is decisive in the organization of perception and apperception, and in as much as we recognize the constant interface with screens, we also begin to recognize that that changes radically language function and the characteristics of consciousness. And as soon as we start to play with language function and what is conscious, we're also saying something about the unconscious, right? We're also recognizing that certain knowledges have to be repressed, but not, and certain things have to be operative without our knowing in order for us to continue to be who we are and think as we do. So, I mean, in the older paradigm, repression was about the repression of drives or the repression of desires. And that's certainly still operative. But what we're what I'm trying to surface in the notion of the computational unconscious is that a lot of what's repressed in our ways of knowing are machine functions. And the protocols of visual culture and the econometrics of visual culture. And that beneath the images that we see, there are all these other vectors networked and operationalized, which give us these images that we have a very superficial understanding of. So our engagement with visual culture and our engagement with the machines themselves, with other kinds of interfaces, they create this social unconscious, which is profoundly operational, continuously functional, and yet very difficult for us to be aware of.
Can you give an example of in what ways are we engaging with visual capital that we don't really understand, but maybe we should, or the ways that we could see what this unconscious and actually bring it into consciousness?
Sure. From a theoretical perspective, I mean, I have in mind some of the ideas from the autonomous movements, particularly some of Paulo Virno's later work, where you have the capture of the cognitive linguistic functions by capital. So effectively, the kinds of things we say and do as we talk to each other or in the workplace are there to make sure that the machines continue to mesh in ways that will valorize capital, that is, make profits. So in a way, there's a colonization of language by the ubiquitous computing that takes place in the workplace and all around. But more concretely, I mean, something that we do all the time, people who post on Instagram or communicate over email or whatever it is, we think we're sending a particular message to a particular person or broadcasting it. And we think that the content of that is the message. And yet, behind and beyond that particular utterance is the validation of this entire media ecosystem, this media ecology, which is fundamentally extractive. So, I mean, the thing about the internet, which it promised freedom and liberation and to break down all the barriers to publishing, and therefore equality, the possibility of equality was whispered as computers were sold and as the internet was promoted. And yet if we take a hard look at it, what we see is that the internet has produced, kinds of hierarchy which are historically unprecedented. We've actually never had people so wealthy now as in the past. And we've also never had such a radical dispossession. 2 billion people living on $2 a day. I mean, it's a fact that is constantly in my mind. Effectively, you have a planet. That was the population of Earth in 1929. So you have an entire planet's futures being canceled by the default operation of our machines of representation and communication. So that's unconscious for most of us, right? That's something that we don't know, and we don't know how to feel. Surfacing some of it theoretically, I would say, however, is a beginning.
And how do you think it looks if and when a person is conscientiously aware of these power structures? For example, on the way they utilize a platform like Instagram.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, this is the thing that Zizek and others have said about ideology. It's like, we know very well, but we do it anyway, right? I mean, so this
is... Right. Right.
Yep. And this is the problem with ideology critique, right? It only goes so far. I mean, if it doesn't change our practice, then it's not really doing its job, which is why I've actually been thinking a lot about protocol redesign and recognizing that part of the difficulty with interfacing with existing machines is that we can't actually change the economic protocols which underpin the code. So the computational protocols are proprietary. They're built on the accumulation of information. And I have a kind of a theory of how information feeds capitalism. I call it informatic labor. But but the production of information is captured by these platforms, and we can't, as users, don't have any access to the network of distribution, which allows for the harvesting of that value, which is socially produced. So there's two things here. One is sort of like the abstraction of our semiotic outputs as in, by the value form as capital, right? And so and the capture of that, which then produces an alienated power and a kind of an alienated intelligence. That's why I think about AI, which has a power over and against most users. And I mean, you could even say, to some extent, the species and the biosphere. Right. So that extractive process is endemic to the way in which the media system, the world media system, and the world computer function. The other thing is that we might want to communicate in such a way that our values are not collapsed into the value form. Right. And so how would we do that? How would we sort of like make certain things that we value, certain forms of care, radical care, persistent in our communications process rather than simply fodder for expropriation?
Where do you think the culpability begins or ends with big tech companies in relation to this?
Yeah, I mean, assigning blame isn't something that I'm really out to do. I mean, there are really bad actors, and there are many, many terrible people who make me sick to my stomach, and there are lots of corporate practices which culminate in war and really violent forms of extraction that I object to. But to me, the conversation really shouldn't be about corporate liability. That's something to know, and there's important work being done on that. And of course, doing harm mitigation is really a very important part of the politics of the day. But the work that I'm focusing on is really a kind of a more, I'd say, anarcho-communist set of pursuits in which people might collectively empower themselves and be answerable to one another rather than sort of looking upwards towards the corporate world or the state and demanding changes there. I mean, I'm really interested in the possibilities of us remaking the world. You know, I mean, not going to our congressmen and asking our congressmen in existing states to sort of rein in these corporations. It's kind of like what Angela Davis talks about in Our Prisons Obsolete. You know, reform has its limits. Yes, prison reform matters, but prison reform is not really the goal. It's prison abolition.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I think, you know, in creating a system where the people can empower themselves is great. And I think that, yeah, corporate, you know, displacing blame or placing blame has its limitations, as you mentioned, in terms of what the reform is. Now, in terms of, you know, people who are in big tech, this kind of, you know, open idea of who those individuals are, they're still run by people, right? And in terms of empowering,
are they?
Right. I mean, perhaps not even anymore. Maybe 20 years ago when it first started, but perhaps, you know, the monster's out of the box now and they don't even know how to reel it in. There is the possibility of that as well. Is there a way even for the quote people that are behind big tech? Is there a way for them to use the ideas that you talk about as humans and actually reform the structure because they're the ones who have the power, or are we just beyond that?
I wouldn't expect too much reform from the slave masters. You know, it's like, I mean, mm-hmm. the Jeff Bezoses and the Mark Zuckerbergs, you know, the of the world, they're not going to save us. in fact, they are what they are because of the condition that the rest of the world is in. And, you know, we can't give them credit for all of the horror that's taken place on the planet, because I see them also as structural conditions. But the conditions of possibility for billionaires is part of the problem. I mean, why do we allow that? You know, why do we tolerate that kind of extractive power in the social? And it's partially because it's been naturalized, partially because capital has been encoding our desire through these visual interfaces for so long that we think that, like, the white male genius deserves in one way or another the billions of dollars that he's gotten by taking the life of other people, right? And this, right. This is a theft of life. This is a theft of futurity, which is, you know, in the bank accounts and in the capabilities of these, you know, very few individuals, you know, the 10 or 50 billionaires that own more than half the wealth on the planet. And when you think about that kind of extraction and that kind of governance system, where the social product is given over to the agency and the whim of a couple of, you know, so-called geniuses, that shows that we've accepted a radical kind of inequality, which is counter to any of our democratic principles, which, by the way, are so antiquated as to be ineffective.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, it's it really is. I mean, the acceptance of this idea that almost like there's a celebrity that's attached to billionaires. There's almost a worshiping of these individuals. So yeah, the radical acceptance of this kind of grotesque wealth disparity within the system and how it continues that way is really, it's incredibly alarming. And really kind of in many ways discouraging, even from like a human perspective. So I definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned
on the celebrity issue. I mean, I've written about that in certain places, but the in Cinematic Mode of Production, I have a short chapter on natural born killers try to make the argument that the celebrity function is based upon the accrual of attention, which is a continuation of the logic of capitalist extraction, that effectively, in a prior moment, maybe you became a sovereign subject through the extraction of other people's labor in leverage exchange by capital. So industrialists, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, people like that. But cinema allows, translates some of those relationships to the visual, and the eye becomes both becomes an instrument of production, and the accrual of attention becomes a means to celebrity and a means to capitalist power. So you have a homologous structure in celebrity. And this is an insight that's been really important to me, and it's not mine alone. It comes also out of Frankfurt School analysis of fascism and Walter Benjamin's notion of the violation of the cinematic apparatus under fascism, where the cinema, could have actually allowed us to cybernetically and prosthetically understand our connections with one another. It was bent to the production of what he calls ritual values or cult values, where you have the cult worship of the celebrity, who's actually the creation of the crowd, right, or the mass audience. But the problem is the mass audience gives their agency over to this individual who then stands in for them.
And you do mention in several parts in the book about cinema, as you've mentioned several times here, as well as radical cinema. Can you discuss a little bit more how you're talking about radical cinema in relation to your larger argument?
There are a couple things. I mean, as I alluded to in the opening comment, the visual as a site of social control and social transformation became a really important part of my thinking, and actually still is. On the one hand, I first grasped the productive potentials of cinema by looking at revolutionary filmmakers, people like Eisenstein and Bertov, of course, but then third cinema makers, particularly Senegalese filmmakers who were able to disrupt the visual field in such a way that was thought to be, as Solanas and Chettino said, catalytic. I mean, that you could actually use the visual to organize people's recreation of the social. And as much as that was possible, it became very clear that it was a site of production. And that the technical outgrowth that it is cinema, the outgrowth from industrialization, allowed for new possibilities in production and social production. At the same time, these capacities were being colonized by the capitalist market, particularly by Hollywood. So Hollywood and the celebrity system, as I described it, begins to reformat the visual field and forms of desire so that people would get some modicum of satisfaction or social currency in exchange for giving their desire and their practice over to the logistics of capitalism. And that's something, like I said, that's really fundamental. So in the current book, like in the World Computer, the films that I've been interested in are films which have kind of dealt with the checkmate of the visual by capital in one way or another, sort of been able to reveal or demonstrate to a certain extent just how deep the visual rabbit hole goes. So for example, I was interested in a film by Kavan de la Cruz, a Filipino filmmaker who made a film called Squatter Punk in the slums on the outskirts of Manila. And unlike ethnographic film, which might give a very careful treatment of its subjects, Kavan manipulates the, using digital editing, manipulates the images almost violently. He solarizes them. He actually entered into the social space of the children that he's filming, and you know, gets a haircut, gets a mohawk, and sort of kind of intervenes in the social and stages certain things. But what one sees in his violent manipulation using digital technology is the simultaneity of the slum and the digital image. And so in a way, I think of his work as just one example of what a possible role for cinema as creating a dialectical image in which there's no longer a possibility of imagining that objects just exist, you know, or subjects just exist. And in fact, the integration of the digital goes all the way down into these social worlds of dispossession. And that you can sort of see through the entire system in a single image. That's why I think of him as creating these dialectical images, because you actually have to look through the history of the world in order to see what you're seeing.
And so you think that his work specifically, or work like that, could be or should be more prominent in cinema, or can be something that kind of breaks away from what cinema really means today, which is a very capitalist mainstream form of image making?
I was giving that only as one example, because, I mean, honestly, I don't think there's a single solution or even one set of practices. I mean, the reason I picked that example is because from that example, we can learn that mediation is different from representation. And that mediation is about the transmission of forces and the creation of networks, and that those are continuously in flux. So that doesn't just like sort of sit there and say we need to make a million films like that. What it suggests is that when we make images or transmit images, we're actually engaging in a process of world making, and the more profoundly we understand what's implied by that and what's the unthought of that, the better chances we might have in making the worlds that we actually want, rather than the ones that we get by the default operation of the codes. So, I mean, more recently, I'm thinking about film as a derivative. It's a derivative on the social, meaning to say that it's a management strategy in which people are risking forms of capital in order to get more value out. So it's a risk management tool. And those can work in a variety of ways. And most of the time they work in financial terms. People wager something. They take a risk of some of their capital in order to get a return of profit, which means that they're constantly in competition for the value form, and in competition, they want to like participate in the extractive logic of our dominant economy. But everyone's not like that, at least not in every part of their life and everywhere. There are other things that we do which are not structured or wagered in that way. Like I mentioned earlier, radical forms of care, certain kinds of solidarity, certain kinds of values which are not on the market for some of us, or at least at some of the time. How do we express that in cinema? How do we use cinema to remake those social relations so that the returns are not simply market returns?
And do you think there's a way for any sort of mainstream cinema to actually create, to build a world that is outside of the capital gains that it seeks? Is it possible to do that, or do we have to find like a new space for it to be experimental and avant-garde, where it moves away from gaining capital?
Yeah, I think the mainstream is not long for this world. I mean, you know, it's like if we have a mainstream in the way that we do for much longer, there's going to be, you know, global collapse. And in fact, we're already living through some of that, where there, you know, and so to me, the focus is more on the practical, the creative, the critical, the relational, and less the prescriptive, right? I mean, so I mean, I I wouldn't want to prescribe to, like, you know, Hollywood what it should do to be more responsible, because I think that the whole system in which an elite coterie of people make films in order to create profits is not going to change very much. It's kind of like, you know, the difference between a Marxist or an abolitionist perspective, or even an anarchist perspective, and a kind of neoliberal perspective, in which, well, if we just get people rights and access to markets, then you know, the world will be better. That doesn't address the social problems at the protocol layer. It doesn't recognize that this is a losing game for someone always. And so, if we really want to remake our social relations, we have to remake economy.
One of the things that you mentioned that I found really fascinating throughout the book is that you talk about the colonization of semiotics. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack that and what you mean by that in relation to your argument here and beyond?
Yeah, well, I mean, it has a lot to do with things that I've mentioned already. This notion of the capturing of the cognitive linguistic by capitalism, the notion that much of our speech functions to allow the current system to continue to persist, the fact that, like, as a young person who goes to school in the United States, if you go to college, you probably take on debt, which means that your mind is already there's a lien on your mind by the banks. And so what you say and do and how you act and what you post and what you allow yourself to write and what you keep yourself from writing is already designed in advance to make sure that those loans get serviced. These processes in which Randy Martin called the financialization of daily life, in which effectively everything we do, every meaning that we make is being judged by a market system, by what I call the world computer, and analyzed for its value potential, means that we're continuously encouraged to convert our meaning capacity to a capitalist enterprise. And so this means that we refuse certain kinds of thinking, we refuse certain kinds of relation, because we feel like it's not in our financial interest. So that this colonization is sort of like the everyday level. Further down, it's kind of the normalization and things we accept as normal or natural. I mean, certain ideas of race and gender, for example, certain ideas about sexuality, which to some people seem like they're just, you know, given by God or tradition or whatever it is. And recognizing that these two have been mobilized, these domains of our life have been mobilized by a system of domination whose interest it is in to control every aspect of the production and reproduction of the social. So this granularity of the hold that racial capitalism has on our everyday practices, our everyday speech, our everyday thinking is what I mean by the colonization of the semiotic. And this colonization is ongoing. Transforming it, as I said, means not only changing the way in which you communicate what we might allow ourselves to think and feel, but also changing our social relations and the cybernetics of our social relations. What kind of machines, what kind of materialities, what kind of connections, what kind of codes do we connect to one another with? Right now, those things are owned by other people. We might own our computers, but the software that runs in them, the internet that connects to, are all fixed capital. We pay rent on those things. We produce value for those things, not for ourselves. So there's a continuous extraction which takes place in all of our communications. Those are the kinds of things we have to address.
And in addressing those things, is there such a thing as a decolonization of semiotics, or is it really just a transformation into something else?
No, I think there is. I mean, the decolonial projects are vast, and I'm a studier of many of them, and I also in my own way try to participate in the decolonial project, because I feel that if the colonization of everyday life and the colonization of meaning has been one with the kind of settling that capitalism has done into planet Earth, then unsettling those relationships is absolutely fundamental. And as I said, I don't think, you know, a single voice or a single person or people or peoples can engage in this process fully. But part of what I'm working on and what I think, you know, I'm particularly suited to do, although, you know, it's certainly not only me who's doing it, is thinking about the decolonization of monetary media and recognizing that this term that I've been working with, economic media, is something which is a colonial medium, something which transmits value and meaning on the same substrate effectively and is has a colonial logic. So if you could analyze the protocols of that, then I think it's possible to decolonize those so that, as I was saying, values become can be abstracted on systems of value transmission, or what we think of as communication, that do not replicate colonial functions. So I'm sort of avoiding saying the word cryptocurrency here, because I think cryptocurrency gets easily collapsed into something which we're ready to dismiss. But I do have this in mind. What I have in mind is the radical redesign of money in a way that does not recapitulate current systems of banking, current systems of extraction. I mean, there's a lot more to say about that, but I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say, if I wanted to sum it up, is that in my own practice, decolonization, my own thinking about decolonization is focused on the possibilities of the decolonization of the money form.
So there's hope.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I've gone a little bit beyond like the Kafka thing where there's hope, but not for us. You know, I actually think that there is a possibility of remaking our relations of communication and valuation so that we can create cooperative forms of solidarity and world making. I don't think it's easy. I think it's actually a tremendous task. But I mean, a lot of my work now is trying to ask others to also work on a project of this kind, right? I mean, how do we think about the protocol layers of money and computation in one kind of framework, and how do we understand them well enough so that we can redesign them?
And when we think about this globally, do you think, is there a space, a place, a country, a subculture that is doing this work of decolonizing?
Well, I think there's a lot of persistent and even uncolonized or resistant to colonial practices everywhere. You know, I mean, when I see the world around me, when I see my students engaging in process of mutual aid, when I think about what's going on in the Philippines, for example, with the pantries, the food pantries that people created in response to pandemic, where markets were created, where, you know, you came and got what you want and you brought what you had. Which were actually closed down by the government as if they were because they were suspected to be communist enticements to communism. So, but these kinds of practices which refuse the strictures of coloniality, plus the many movements and the tremendous amount of work there to reclaim, transmit, care for the knowledges of First Peoples. I mean, there are many things that are taking place which I think are very promising and necessary to a livable future. I mean, at least livable for most of us.
There's hope. That makes me feel better about it. One of the chapters, you have switching a little bit. There's in chapter two, the computational mode of production. You really kind of highlight this really interesting argument about the programmable image of a photo capital, where you're talking about image code, image, and just the computational representation of data visualization. You also talk about the geopolitics of the selfie and just this general idea of the programmable image. Can you talk a little bit more about that and kind of how you're looking at the code and the image and money?
Sure. So I mean, those chapters are really about, I mean, the computational mode of production understands that the images that we use are the result of prior codifications. And in as much as they're codifications, meaning that they're the results of concepts, which are translated to machine functions. I mean, from the optics, you know, you think about optics as a set of mathematical insights that are then translated to into glass. You know, with earlier photography and celluloid, and you had the chemical formulas, which were also conceptualized, translated onto the receiving surface behind the lens so that the photons could alter those chemicals in order to create an image. These things are not just sort of windows into the world, as Willem Flusser tells us, but they are forms of computing. They are the abstract operation of concepts designed to give particular results. And so the image becomes a kind of program. And I drew a lot on Flusser's work in this book because something that Flusser said has really stuck with me, which is, if you think about the 20th century, I mean, the cameras have organized the world for the benefit of cameras, right? And the vast proliferation of cameras, if you see that as sort of like an evolutionary vector, it's taken over the ecology of the planet, according to something that he refers to sometimes as the photographic program. This is a computational program as far as he's concerned, and I really build on this. I mean, the thing is that he's less interested in, but I think is really important, is that it's also a program of capital. Given what I was saying about attention economy earlier and the image as an interface with the eye, which is then can capture value, effectively industrializing the eye, then you have a program for value extraction, which becomes, you know, increasingly prevalent as we move from the 20th century into the 21st. As digital culture sort of sutures itself to screens and absorbs all prior media in what's called convergence, you have not only the convergence of media and computation, but I argue the convergence of capital and computation. So computational racial capital, the computational mode of production, these become ways of rethinking the meaning of and function of screens. So the programmable image means, one, that its images are programmed. You can think paradigmatically of advertising, but also, given what I've said, also things like Hollywood, as creating social programs which not only extract in the instance of consumption, but also design audience and peoples for further extraction several cycles down the line, right? So you have this curating of the senses and practices and beliefs by the images, because people are being programmed by their function, and these functions are organized by the aspirations of capital to continuously create profits for itself. Of course, these programs also include programs for racialization, programs for gender identification, and promulgate many of the violences endemic in our current systems the racist system and the heteropatriarchal system of kind of white capitalist supremacy and capitalism. So that those are part of the programming dimensions, which are organized, as it were, from above or by many people unconsciously, because the way you make an image has already been learned so deeply and profoundly that those things have been naturalized. The programmable image also implies the possibility that our interface with images can reinflect the meanings of those images. So the question becomes, how do we reinflect them? Do we reinflect them so that we get a little share of capital as well, but nonetheless valorize capital? Or are there other dynamics in which we can reinflect images and program them to do a different kind of work and create different orders of social relations than simply the default ones that validate capital? So this is the space. This question of the programmable image becomes a very important understanding of the interface and also of labor, because it says that one of the things that's happening as we interface with images is we're producing new information, and that new information is a form that is actually what can be extracted by the fixed capital that is global computing, and in fact, I guess the suggestion is, maybe it's more than a suggestion, it's a claim, even an argument, that this has become the paradigmatic form of capitalist production. And when you look back retrospectively at other moments in production, you can see emerging the process of creating state changes in matter as fundamentally the way in which the hieroglyphics of the commodity were read by capital. What is the value of something? Well, it's the abstract universal labor time in that thing. How do you know what's there? You understand the change that's been made on that material and compare it to the changes that have been made in the rest of the material world. And so this was, in a way, you could say that capitalism was always already a form of computing.
And this kind of gets me to think about a chapter further along when you bring in Banksy and how Banksy talks about advertising in public space and how he kind of sees it as, you know, if you see any advertisement in a public space, it really kind of gives you no choice, whether you see it or not. So it belongs to you and you can rearrange it. It's uses this idea that it's like if somebody, you know, it's like asking permission for someone to, if they throw a rock at your head, to ask permission to keep it. So, but really when we look at his film, Exit Through the Gift Shop, there's really, it shows that it's a much more nuanced than that, right? And you mentioned like really the capitalization of perception depends on a transformed network of relations that is between the vision and the social practices. So advertising is just really not that simple. Can you talk a little bit more about that and that kind of relationship of public space and advertising?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the terrifying realization which informed that chapter was that advertising was actually one version of the general case, which is that all of these images are in competition for the capturing of our attention and the accrual of capital. So, I mean, this notion of Banksy's notion of the advertisement being a rock thrown at your head and then claiming, as you say, that it's yours, you know, it's ridiculous to ask permission to keep it when it was such an aggressive act, is sort of a claiming of rights to these images, which are oftentimes thought of as proprietary. So there's kind of a punk or anarchist dimension to this part of Banksy where, yeah, take it, you know, use it for whatever you want, because it's an assault weapon that was directed at you. So in your own defense and in the defense of the things you care about, take advantage of it. Do something else with it. The other thing that happens in that chapter is an answer. I try to answer a question which... You asked me in a different way earlier, which is whether or not, it's enough to control advertising on the internet, and would that be of some use? And my answer, I think, is yeah, that might help. But the problem is, what if it's all advertising, right? What if the basic way things are structured right now is that everything has been converted into advertising, and advertising is paradigmatic? If that's the case, then we're in this attention wars, where the only possibility for expression, or the what would like to pass itself off as the only possibility for expression, is that you yourself become an advertiser and accrue other people's attention for your own benefit. Right? That's neoliberalism. Right? That's sort of like saying, well, it's capitalism everywhere, so let's just get ourselves and some people we care about enfranchised in this, in this infernal machine, and forget the fact that somebody else is going to pay the price. And that is the challenge I see. That the challenge is really how to do other things with information and with money forms, because those right now are operating in a colonial mode, so the question of decolonization becomes, how do we decolonize representation, communication, finance, etc., which sounds almost impossible. Partially because the way in which our imagination has been captured. But again, I mean, Angela Davis is a huge influence on my thinking, but as Angela Davis says about prison abolition, which is that, in that book, Our Prison's Obsolete, she talks about before the abolition of slavery, many people, even people who were against slavery, couldn't imagine the end of slavery because it became such a permanent feature in the landscape. Similarly, with prison abolition movement, people have sort of naturalized the prison system and think that, a society without prisons couldn't function. That's the colonization of the imagination. And so it's a work of the imagination to displace the naturalization of that to the point where we can begin to imagine and actually practice the creation of futures which don't include a carceral system. And similarly, I think that's kind of where I'm at with our current money system and the monetary protocols. It's hard to know what the world will feel like if if accounting had a very, very different valence. But pre-capitalist forms of accounting did exist. And I would like to believe that post-capitalist forms of accounting will also exist and that capitalism will not end up destroying our planet.
So ultimately, you're saying there's hope and there's a ton of work we have to do.
There's a ton of work, and I mean, there's hope, but I don't want to sound, I don't want to be naive either. I mean, I don't think any of these struggles are trivial. I mean, for me, it's been a personal challenge, even to like go along this line of thought, because there's so many red flags. I mean, imagine somebody who spent most of their life thinking about political economy through a Marxist lens, and I still do. But imagine somebody coming around and saying, "Well, look, you know, let's think about finance differently. Let's think: is there a possibility of radical finance? Can we actually finance the revolution, right? And can we finance the revolution in such a way that we create the values necessary to revolutionize the social, and not make that into a profit system?" Can we create cooperatives, as I was saying? Can we create relations of production, networks of production and relation, which are just and which are fair as far as all players are concerned, and do so in a way that is not damaging to others outside of those networks? I think that's a very difficult thing even to ask. I mean, and to answer it is is harder still.
It is. It's the idea of like, well, if you smash one, you know, ideology, what's going to replace it? Or how do you replace it? Right? If you're just going to get rid of capitalism, there's going to be another ism that's going to replace it. But what will that be? What will that look like? So yeah, I mean, you're really presenting some, you know, there's so much. I mean, even for me personally, there's so many things in your book that I think are incredibly thought-provoking and very much needed into the conversation, because you know, what can we do? How can we decolonize? You know, when you mentioned like the colonization of the imagination, that's really a terrifying thought in a lot of different ways, to really think about how things became naturalized, the idea of the prison system, the idea of slavery, you know, the act of that and how it just became ingrained in culture. So it really is, in many ways, I think, terrifying to us to see that reality. And then what can we really do to make it better? That's a big question. It's a very big question.
It is indeed.
Yeah. So, so as we wrap up this really enlightening conversation, what's next for you? What is, after you wrote this wonderful enlightening book, what are you currently working on, or what are you hoping for the future with this?
Well, I'm actually working on a book which I think now is going to be called Notes for the Decolonization of Money. And I'm trying to take some of do some of the work that I said ought to be done.
Yeah, great.
And it's difficult to do it well. And I'm sort of like shifting fields a little bit as I think more about economics and finance than I have done in the past. But I am really interested in systems of account and the way in which monetary issuance takes place. I'm interested in the emergence of cryptocurrency as a new medium. And just to make, you know, since this is a podcast, I just want to make it clear for anybody who might be listening. No, I do not think that Bitcoin is a revolution. No, I do not think that Bitcoin is going to save the world, or Ethereum for that matter. But what I do think is interesting about these things is the possibility of taking money away from the complete control of nation states and creating money forms that carry with them different narratives and other meanings. So for example, you know, the US, if you hold US dollars, I mean, you're invested in the US, whatever you might say, your wealth and power depends upon the continuation of the US state. And that narrative is operative consciously and unconsciously for probably anyone who holds that currency. Bitcoin has a different narrative, right? And without going into the details of that, I want to just know the semantic dimension of what functions as a currency. These are really, really narrow band narratives, right? They can barely, you know, tell a story. But we could imagine a much more robust narrativity to our, what we think of as our monetary forms, which tell the stories of connection, which tell the stories of relation, tell the stories of production. And this is sort of like the remaking of communications and of what I call economic media in a decolonial mode, where many of us can be the authors of our currencies, right? And that we can collectively author currencies in a way which carries with it the social imaginations which we care about. And so that's kind of the next book. This possibility of doing to the economic system what the internet was supposed to do to the world of publishing and representation, breaking down the walls.
Wonderful. Well, we're looking forward to those notes, Jonathan. That'll be great.
Thank you.
And I'd love to have you come on and talk about that book when you get it done. That'll be a fun conversation.
No, thanks so much.
So, I look forward to that. Thank you again. Thank you again, Jonathan, for joining us. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Until next time, everyone. Cheers.